So my name is Michael Ellis. Welcome to the second debate we have going here between Eric Samuelson and Gideon Burton. So James Goldberg provided a bit of introduction for each of them. So Eric Samuelson and Gideon Burton are past presidents of the Association of Mormon Letters. Both are prolific writers. Plan B Theater Company recently dedicated an entire season to plays by Eric. And Gideon Burton once wrote an original sonnet per day for a year for an online project. That is something. In addition to his poetic accomplishments, Gideon is a professor with expertise in Mormon literature, the Renaissance, and new media, who has consistently pushed students to do more than going through the motions of a degree-based education. In addition to writing great plays, Eric Samuelson mentored a generation of writers at BYU who are blessed by his wide-ranging interests and encouraged by his lively sense of humor. He is a proud descendant of opinionated Norwegians and lives by his grandfather's motto that a good man never lies to his bishop, cheats on his wife, or crosses a picket line. Their debate today is over the question, should Mormon writers study Mormon literature? Gideon will be taking the pro side, arguing that they should make it a priority. Eric will take the con side and offer an alternative perspective on priorities. So the way this will go is we'll have opening arguments for 7 minutes each. The rebuttals will then be 3 minutes each. And then we'll open up the... open up to questions from the audience until 40 after, and then we'll have 5 minutes each to do closing arguments. So, who would like to go first?
Well, I'll go first, and I just want to say from the start that I plan to violate those rules. I don't know that I have 7 minutes to start with, but I'll dive right in. Should Mormon writers study Mormon literature? I think this is, the answer is yes, but I also find that it's a problematic question, and maybe that's where we will get into some of the fisticuffs. And first of all, you know, what is a Mormon writer? What is the study of Mormon literature, what's the Mormon part of that, and what's the literature part of that? Every one of those, I think, is a little bit problematic. From the last session, if you were in the other room, there was a discussion about the Mormon literary scene, and there was some different frameworks that people were thinking about when they're discussing Mormon literature. So one of those frameworks was looking at the niche market for Mormon fiction, Desert Book, and that sort of thing. And so I think that people would answer differently if they had that in mind. Should Mormon writers study the fiction that is sold at Desert Book? It's a different question than a broader take on that. I'd like to answer it in the most general sense and say if people are self-identifying as Mormon in their faith or in their writing to any degree, even that sort of stealth mode of Mormon writing where you're trying not to necessarily make things obvious about your faith, but still trying to have your beliefs and your background shine through. If you are among those people that you know, you care about your faith at the same time that you care about your craft and you care about connecting the two of them, not everyone does. But if you are in that lot, then I think it is certainly wise to see how others have trod that path. So they should read Douglas Thayer and see how he has explored issues of Mormon boyhood and teenagers' relationships with mothers, and those are big things in Mormon society. Coming of age is a big deal for Mormons, and Doug has handled that in some really interesting ways and some very overt ways. And then you have others who have handled the same themes, but in a very different way. So we have this proliferation of young adult authors in Mormondom. And they are generally treating the coming-of-age thing as well, but maybe for a different market and a little different approach than Douglas Thayer has. But if we are choosing to ignore our cultural heritage and those that have made great efforts to try to bring together the their religious and literary sensibilities, then you know, we're fated to make some of the mistakes that others have made before us and not learn from those. Or we may miss out on great opportunities to see how some have navigated those waters successfully. Let me just give an example. I'll give a negative and a positive one. The negative one would be not only somewhat negative, if we go way back in time to Nephi Anderson, who was writing around the turn of the 20th century, and really the first Mormon novelist. He wrote Added Upon, Dorian, and some other works. Someone just put out Dorian in a new edition. Who did that?
Peculiar Pages.
Yeah, I was very pleased to see that. Anyway, his novel writing is atrocious in on so many levels that it's a little bit embarrassing, except when you see he made this good faith effort, at least in Added Upon, to try to write a plan of salvation fiction where you try to get that whole cosmology in from the LDS point of view. It's not an easy trick to do in 200 pages. And he didn't particularly pull it off, but he played with form in some very interesting ways that at least gives you a point of reference that, okay, well, maybe ending your novel in long lines of blank verse isn't really going to satisfy the crowd, even though it may suggest the exaltation you're trying to represent. It didn't work, but it gives you some ideas. I'm down to 2 minutes. I thought I couldn't fill. Here I am. So it's good to see even the mistakes of our predecessors, if nothing else, as cautionary tales, but I think more often as inspiration. On the other side of that, you take someone like Orson Scott Card, who's well known for his writing less explicitly Mormon sorts of things. His most famous works, people in general, are not going to associate with Mormon literature. But those of us who are LDS and read Orson Scott Card, we see his Mormonism all over the place, and not just in his explicit Mormon fiction, which is really the minority of his works. And I particularly like the novel Passwatch, where there's some themes about the spirit of Elijah and so on, saving your ancestors, etc. But never the word Mormon comes up in that novel, but it's very much filled with that sense of trying to do something important for those that have come before you. So the short version is, yes, we should write. Those who want to write Mormon literature ought to study the heritage that is theirs for them to claim, even if they want to define themselves against that.
Well, I want to start first by agreeing with Gideon that I think it's a problematic question, but what I'd like to do with it is to ask this question, which is what ought a writer or a young writer or a prospective writer read? What ought we to read? And it seems to me that the kind of reading we should do is in three categories. First of all, we should read as much as we can of the very best work in the area or the field or the direction or the genre that we want to pursue. So if you want to be a fantasy writer, then absolutely you should read Brandon Sanderson or Brandon Mull or Dave Wolverton, not because they're Mormon, but because they're among the very, very best at what they do. We should also, of course, read other great fantasy writers. You should read as much as you can if that's how you want to define yourself, if that's the kind of work you want to do. Second of all, I would say, to finish that thought, however, if you want to write literary fiction, I don't necessarily think that Brady Udall would be a writer you would need to read. He's an outstanding writer in that field. But there are other writers who are as accomplished, as well-read, as important. And again, you should read a lot of the kind of thing you want eventually to write. Second, of course, we have to read for research purposes. We have to find out the facts and that inform the things that we want to write. And that's much, much easier now than it ever was before, ever in history. I found myself yesterday for a writing project needing to know something about squirrel-proof bird feeders. And in the past, that would have required multiple trips to pet stores and hardware stores and, I don't know, outdoor gardening supply stores. But all it took yesterday was a 30-second Google search, and in 15 minutes, I had everything I needed. Still, there are times you have to read big, hard, long books about whatever the subject is that you've chosen to write about. And you have to become reasonably expert in those areas. In fact, it's one of the great joys of being a writer, is the opportunity to really immerse yourself in subjects that you would probably never really look at otherwise. The third kind of writing, though, is the one I think that this question is directed towards, which is when we read for pleasure. What should we, as writers, read when we don't have to read something because of what we're working on? And my answer to that is, first of all, if you want to be a writer, I believe you should read prodigiously. You should read promiscuously. You should read anything. You should read the backs of cereal boxes. You should read all the time as much things as you can possibly read. And you should absolutely read lots and lots of crap. You should read... I would also suggest that if you want to be a writer today, you should watch a lot of television. And there's two reasons for that. One is that television seems to be the one place in mass media where writers control the process. And we're really, really good writers like David Simon with The Wire or Matt Wiener, who writes Mad Men, or are creating long-form works of just remarkable accomplishment. But I also think that we should read things that we've been warned against and read things that we've been told aren't good for us. When I was an undergraduate at BYU, my professors all warned us against the unholy trilogy of Mamet, Shepherd, and Albee. And we were just to avoid those three writers above all. And then I went to graduate school, and my office mate, who I'd become very close with, I was directing Mamet's play, American Buffalo. And he asked me to come see it, and I wanted to go out of loyalty to my friend, but didn't want to go because I was certain it would corrupt me. And it did corrupt me. And I couldn't be more delighted. But I remember that experience of seeing something that I'd been warned against and how moved I was by it, how touched I was by it, how much I grew from watching it, and thinking a very healthy thought, which was that everything I'd been told by my professors was wrong. And I really hope that those of my students who are here are saying that to themselves as well, that everything I told you was probably wrong and you should ignore it.
It's on a sign outside of my house. So
what ought we to read? I think we should read everything and anything, but I don't feel any particular necessity of specifically reading works by LDS authors simply because we're LDS, any more than I feel a need to read works by Indiana writers because I'm from Indiana, or American writers because I'm an American, or white male writers because I'm a white male. I think we should read as broadly and as widely as we can, and that we should never be afraid to read stuff that's likely to be bad for us.
30 seconds.
So, when friends of mine found that I was taking this subject for this debate against Gideon, they said, "So you're taking on Orson F. Whitney?" And as I came in here, Dennis Clark said that he was portraying Orson F. Whitney today. I don't know what Shakespeare's and Milton's of our own means.
Ones we can control.
Well, I just took some notes while you were speaking.
Oh, good.
just correct me if I got this wrong. Read crap. Watch TV. Study what you've been warned against. Never be afraid to read something that's bad for you.
Yes.
I don't think I really need to do any rebuttal. When I was young, I had those sorts of crazy liberal ideas. But as of last week, I became a grandfather. And now I see the world differently. I want to protect my granddaughter from people like you. If you go online and look for crap, you will find it. I actually agree with Eric with respect to the general sense of a liberal education, to read broadly, and especially to look for the good that's come out of so many other traditions other than just our own. So we don't disagree about that. But I do feel as though that we are, you know, we're in a world with too much information, we're glutted with things, we do need to have critics to guide us towards things that are of greater value. I think that's one reason to look at things that are canonical, because they have stood the test of time, because they continue to nourish ongoing generations, and so they do deserve our attention. But there's a lot of things that are very popular that, and I'm sure some would disagree with me, but I don't think they deserve our attention. So 50 Shades of Grey, I'm going to pass. And I think there are a lot of other things that we could worry about, not just necessarily for their moral valence, but just for their general quality. With the ability for so many people to self-publish today, you don't have the gatekeeping that used to be there with editors. And that's a very good thing in some respects, because some people are getting chances that they wouldn't have otherwise. But then sometimes I recoil in horror to think that anyone can publish things just because they have a typewriter or a keyboard. It's a dangerous thing. So I think that Mormons who want to write, they certainly can be nourished by many traditions, and not just our own, but even at that, I think there needs to be a certain level of discretion and scrutiny, and to go to guides in order to do that. I can pause right there.
I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey. And would sooner face the gallows. At the same time, I can imagine an LDS writer, I can imagine a circumstance in which an LDS writer might find that book immensely liberating, quality of prose notwithstanding. I don't know who that writer might be, but I certainly agree with Gideon in that there used to be gatekeepers and critical gatekeepers warning us towards, warning us against works that we ought to pursue for moral reasons. And I wouldn't want my grandchild, if I had one, to, there are things I would rather she not read until she's old enough and able to make those decisions for herself. But if I can damn myself with my own words again, isn't there also a worry about self-censoring out of considerations of taste and saying, I don't want to read that because it's vulgar. I don't want to read that. Vulgar, I don't mean necessarily in the sense of language, but vulgar in the sense of written for vulgus humanus, written for common folk. And I think, if I can be serious for a moment, the single biggest threat we have to actually accomplishing much as LDS writers is self-censorship. Is the voice in our head that says, my character shouldn't do that, or shouldn't say that, or shouldn't go there, out of considerations external to the needs of the story.
But I'll dive in there and say that I think that's all the more reason why it's valuable for LDS writers to read within our tradition, because we really have had some great authors that have dared to explore some of the difficult issues, and you're among those. I was really intrigued by my students in my Mormon class this semester, and I had them reading Out of the Mount, that collection of plays from New Play Project, and some of them read your play Gaia and didn't like it, and responded rather negatively about how you depicted Eve and Satan arguing with one another, and I didn't agree with them, but I certainly allowed them to have their say, and it generated a good conversation. And it gives people a chance to wrangle with our beliefs and our doctrines in a safe zone, because it's fiction, but a place where there are real stakes, because there are real beliefs that are involved. Another example, we read Melissa's play Little Happy Secrets, which, if you don't know that play, it's an excellent play, and it deals with the issue of same-sex attraction, and in a very engaging, honest, and tasteful way. And when I first had my students reading that, I was a little bit apprehensive, because the subject was a little touchier, things have opened up a bit, and it's not quite that way. But a lot of LDS kids don't have an on-ramp to discuss some of these difficult issues. They don't have a safe zone in which to do that. And I'm very grateful that we have a lot of brave authors in our tradition that have given a way to start doing that. So, if nothing else, it gives you a venue other than the rather restricted zone of Sunday meetings where people can talk seriously about current issues and sometimes troubling issues and come to terms with them even within our own culture and faith tradition.
Let's open it up to the audience for questions, and we'll go till 20 till.
I kind of want to segue that into, Eric, you've written a lot of LDS plays.
Yes.
A lot of non-LDS plays.
Yes.
And kind of these give you an interesting platform there. And this goes to Gideon as well. For a Mormon writer, once we've read whatever it is we're supposed to read, what are we supposed to write? Have you found it liberating to write for a specifically non-LDS audience, which doesn't even play into it? And what about the your BYU plays and whatnot? Did you find liberating in writing in the LDS tradition?
Well, I found both modes of writing to be liberating and freeing. What ought we to write? Anything you doggone well want to write. I mean, I don't know. What do you want to write next?
Do you think it's worthwhile writing the LDS?
Well, okay.
For you personally.
I mean, first of all, this is a little bit of a fraudulent debate. Gideon and I are both past presidents of the Association of Mormon Letters.
Might have turned.
It's all in the past.
When I was asked to participate on this debate, my one question for James was, which side do you want me to take? Yes, absolutely. There are wonderful, wonderful books by LDS authors which have touched my soul and which I cherish to this day. I think of Levi Peterson prominent among them. I also agree with Gideon that there's a lot of stuff that isn't very good. But I don't know when I've enjoyed a movie experience more than seeing AML's screening of Corianton. which is...
A Tale of Unholy Love.
Boy, is it ever. And it's a dreadful movie at every possible level. But historically, immensely important and immensely rewarding, looked at as a historical artifact. At the same time, I don't... I really think that Mormon literature, defined as Mormon by Mormons about Mormons, has perhaps been too restricting in our view, too restrictive in our vision, too concerned about the public relations implications of any piece of writing for the overall church. And I say that as somebody who is personally and deeply committed to the gospel and to my own ward and to my own covenants, but there is something very freeing about abandoning that question. How will this look? How will this be taken? What will this do to the image brought to conceive of the church?
I just want to point out, I was at a Life University conference like several years ago, and Eugene England was talking about something, I can't remember what, but as part of what he was saying, he mentioned Pierre, or the ambiguities, by... Yes, Hermanov. And he pointed out that it is so nihilistic a piece of literature that no one should ever read it. I was sitting next to Connie Willis. I don't know if anybody knows who she is. She was the guest of honor that year. And she smacked me on the arm. She says, well, now I'm going to go out and get it. She said, I'd never even heard of it. But now I'm going to go get that book.
Right.
So if you really want somebody to read something, tell them that it's not good for them. They should never read it.
Yeah.
I want to pick up this subject of criticism, which you mentioned. And as a young Mormon writer, I was determined to keep my faith and also become a Mormon writer. What I needed most was to improve my craft. And to improve my craft, what I needed most was excellent, responsible, and insightful criticism. So the search for that, I couldn't learn how to write poetry by reading Mormon poets. I discovered that really quickly because there just wasn't enough in the tradition. Fiction may be a little better, but nothing in poetry. So I had to find a critic and who was also a critic of critics so I could really find my way. Luckily, I found a critic who was also a theist and who grounded me in the fact that whatever we write, Mormon, non-Mormon, about sex or morality or whatever we write about, we are taking a moral stance. That there is, not the moral stance that you learn in Sunday school of keeping the commandments, although that's important, but it's what Ben Johnson said in the conversations with Drummond, where he said, speak that I may know you. When we speak, when we write, people learn our morality, a morality, whatever morality we have, meaning our standards, our value. And so learning that grounded me, and I also had a guide into who how to read writers and see what their morality was, but learn their craft. So what we really need in Mormon literature, in my view, is a review of Mormon literature put out by critics. Now, Dennis, years ago, wrote some articles in Sunstone in which he gave close readings of Mormon poetry. We need, you know, the new criticism has gone out the window, you know, and so we've lost the ability to very carefully analyze texts and for their quality and their quantities. And I think this is a real loss that has to go somewhere in the middle of your debate on, you know, this or that and one side or another, because people are going to write what they're going to write.
Let's go with that gentleman and then James.
I guess I just want to speak a little bit in a mini soliloquy against this idea of literature, or at least the word literature as it's being used here. As you know, you go into bookstores here in Utah County, and there'll be a literature section, and there'll be a drama section, and there'll be a poetry section, and there'll be an essay section. It's like, what are you talking about literature? Not to mention the music section, or the religion section, or the computer section. How is that not literature?
Or the New Age spirituality section.
Yeah. So, and of course, it's a broader notion of literature that is typically embraced and embodied in this organization, if we may call it that, which says, well, literature is fiction and drama and poetry and memoir. I think that's sort of the categories that are included in the term as it's being used even in this session. But I'm a Mormon writer. I've published 5 books with University of Illinois Press. And the main difference is mine have footnotes. But you know, there are a lot of, I just want to, I guess, push back against any ghettoization of Mormon literature as being those things, because there are some terrific Mormon historians, for example, who really write well, not all of them, but there are some that write really well, but for some reason, even though their books have more, that make them as authors more vulnerable in the culture in many cases, to those who write fiction, memoir, drama, poetry. They have the potential for massive effect on the culture. Let me just end with this thought. I mean, I love this. It's my favorite Mormon book and why it matters. And I'm going to the poetry section. I'm going to miss that. I thought, if I ever asked that, I would say, like that, I would say, No Man Knows My History, because it's such a beautifully written book. But beyond that, there's no book in the history of the church in the 20th century, really, at least, that has torqued Mormon thought more than that book. And it is the great gauntlet in Mormon literature that has been thrown down in the 20th century, at least, in my opinion. But I don't think it would get talked about that way, because it's not in the, you know what I mean, in the sort of canonic view of literature. So I just want to fade up a little bit, or at least try to fertilize that a little bit, the notion of Mormon literature as we normally speak about it. I have a question.
I would just say, you get in trouble for what you write, so you count.
Well, when you have a general authority write anonymously these words, which were written to my boss at BYU in 1989, he has broken his trust with us. He has said some things we thought he would not say. And I had 2 responses. One was, that's good. The second one was, I don't think you know me enough to know what I wouldn't say.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But, it's because you're saying things that are often about people in positions of veneration.
Right.
Or things that have been done.
So the question that I had for the debaters, if you kind of play a game, if, I don't know, obviously we're going to read Mormon and non-Mormon books in the course of our lives. Do you have any things where you would say, Gideon, if this is what you're reading otherwise, bring this Mormon lit work into conversation with it. And conversely, Eric, if you're reading this Mormon work and you really like it, here's something you might not have thought of. I don't know, would you guys be willing to do some pairing exercises for us that way?
I could budge a little.
Yep.
What about your granddaughter?
Well, I think we are in a new generation, to pick up on that theme, where a lot of the assumptions we might have made about literature are not, they don't apply as much anymore, because we live in such a media-rich environment where the narratives we're experiencing and the types of things that used to feed us from literary sources, we're getting that from multiple sources now. So that's why I find it difficult to talk about Mormon literature without talking about Mormon film and Mormon blogs. And you have these also kind of new versions of old genres. So you have you've got Lance Larson writing wonderful poetry, but then we also have, you know, the Mormon Poetry Slam that Tyler Chadwick is doing online. And so you have new ways of experiencing the old genres and new players that are involved with that. Maybe that cries all the more the need for criticism, but we're not going to find that criticism within the traditional kinds of literary outlets, even Dialogue and Sunstone. Sorry, Boyd.
Sorry. It's okay.
It's a participant in the conversation, but we're competing for, you know, people that have all these media streams. They're binging on Netflix, and they're consuming all these different, you know, Instagram and et cetera, et cetera. And these aren't necessarily bad things. They're enriching the ways that we represent ourselves and talk about things and even invent new ways of being artistic and literary. But we have to get into the game there and see what's going on. And in the last session, Doug was talking about how maybe we don't have an adequate criticism. But I looked up your books on Goodreads in between sessions, and I saw that there were tens and tens of reviews of your books on Goodreads. So it might be that we just don't know where to look, because a lot of these conversations are happening. They're just not happening where we grew up watching for criticism. Anyway.
One doesn't have to use obscene language to describe obscenity. In fact, I think to use obscene language to, and I'm talking about all kinds of obscenity, detracts, it seems to me. I think of a book by a man named Sledge, with the old breed at Okinawa and Peleliu, an 18-year-old young man, a Marine, Second World War, who fought through some of the most horrific battles that a person could ever fight through in a very personal, you know, way. And he doesn't use obscene language of any kind. And yet he describes obscenity. And we look at the, you know, the great Russian writers, and they wrote about everything with incredible insight and understanding. You simply don't have, if you have a character who habitually uses obscene language, you feel you have to, you might, I would say, write about another character, frankly, but it sounds very interesting to me. But the most interesting characters are not, in my view, the obscene people, and they're people who live fairly ordinary lives and who have ordinary conflicts. We somehow think that to, you know, keep attention or to be honest, we have to be obscene as writers. I don't think that's true. I think obscenity pulls you away from what's important. It's an easy out, a very easy out.
Okay, one more, and then maybe you guys can respond to these two comments in your closing.
Okay. You talked about self-censorship as far as reading goes, and I think Mormons especially are famous for censoring and not consuming certain types of media because we feel it disagrees with our morals, but I've also heard of people self-censoring against kitsch, and I was wondering what you guys thought about that. Is that a healthy self-censorship, or should we also be worried about dismissing a book because someone's told us it's kitschy?
Eric is in favor of all crap.
Well, I think that's a wonderful point, because let's face it, kitsch is a pejorative word. Sentimental is a pejorative word. Crap is a pejorative word. To give an example, from just last night, my wife and I went to a movie, and we went and saw the new Kenneth Branagh Cinderella movie. And we were told by people that the film was sentimental, which it is, and that it was kitschy, which it is, and that it was therefore not a particularly good movie. And I would say both of those words apply to it, but what I loved about it was how unabashedly romantic it was and how sweet-natured it was. And I was blown away by it. And I thought it was absolutely freaking gorgeous. You know? Just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful film. So there's such a thing as honest sentiment. I think what we mean is works that seem deliberately to manipulate our emotions in a way that's dishonest or unearned. But what's dishonest or unearned for me may very well be deeply powerful and very much earned for you. I hate it when people talk about an artist as having sold out. I don't know that. That's not a, that seems almost more a moral judgment than an aesthetic one. I don't know what prompted that piece of writing. I don't know what caused someone to write that particular work. So, this is part of what I mean by don't be afraid of crap. Don't be afraid to write, to read things. The definition of a snob is someone who can't ever like anything because they're always afraid that someone snobbier than them is going to look at them snobbishly and say, oh, so that's the kind of thing you like. In response to Mike's comment about literature and about expanding the boundaries of literature, I have a friend who is a Reddit ninja. Is that literature? He's incredibly good at it. I love Lance Larson's poetry. But I also love the experience I had at Marianne Hale's free verse night. Marianne, what do you call
creative,
that?
Creative Writing Open Mic.
The Creative Writing Open Mic, which I promise I will come back to someday. because it's so uncensored, it's so raw, it's so deeply personal. And above all, it's so young. You know? I'm tired of going to plays where at the age of 59, I'm the youngest person in the room. Anyway, I guess that's what I'm saying. Let's read more promiscuously.
Any other adverbs you could use?
So you got 1 minute.
Doug, I love you, and I love your writing, and you're one of the great mentors of my life, but I do disagree with you.
Well, I obviously disagree with you.
Good. And it goes back to part of what I said about television. I'm really not kidding. The best writing happening in America right now is happening in television. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. David Foster Wallace said he had to compete with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
There certainly isn't much happening in fiction. I don't know how real merit.
I just finished binging. I do this. I go on Netflix, and then I binge on a TV series until I've watched all of it. And I just finished binging on The Wire, and the level of accomplishment, the writing in that show, which is profane and vulgar beyond characterization, is nonetheless so marvelous and so human and so raw and so real.
All I'm saying is it isn't necessary. You can do it if you want to. but it isn't necessary. There are ways to get around or not do it and still get effectual.
I think is it depends on the story you're telling and the characters you're portraying. For some characters, it wouldn't be necessary.
Okay, time. Gideon, you've got 5 minutes.
I think maybe an earlier point I might have brought up but didn't is that I feel as though the study of Mormon literature can provide a sort of perspective that is a kind of healthy liberal view on life literature generally, and that might be more benefit than actually the works that you've read. What I mean by that is that if you are reading people that are trying honestly to grapple with the most authentic issues and bring to that their most authentic beliefs, even those beliefs that are maybe caught in tensions that we live in, and it gives you faith in humanity. It gives you faith in the process that art is viable, that Jesus is viable, and that somewhere in the mix I can have a good experience for myself and for other people. So to me, I have a lot of faith that I can continue to experience literature without it necessarily corrupting my soul, even if I do experience things that are maybe not to my taste or that I might even find to be profane. My Mormonism gives me the freedom to aggressively seek out the good in new forms and in new genres, new topics. But I also have the freedom to trust my intuition and the Holy Ghost to give myself a sense of discretion and timeliness. And some things I used to read, I don't read anymore. And other things I return to and I read over and over again. And to me, that's part of getting to know yourself and trusting your own aesthetic and spiritual abilities. I think not every Mormon sees literature the same way, and obviously not every Mormon sees Mormonism the same way. But I found generally that those who are within this area of trying to make good faith efforts to do something serious with these particular artistic and literary tools, it's a good group to be in, and it's worth paying attention to these efforts. And I'd like to say especially those that are a little bit newer and foreign to some of us that grew up in a purely literary or belletristic tradition. So I'm very happy to see some of the experiments that are going on. And I think I have to have a certain degree of humility to watch and see how these new flowers grow and bloom, whether it's a new publishing effort or whether it's a new podcast or whether it's a new web series or these new genres. My Mormonness, I feel, makes me have to stay open to those new kinds of expression and help to see the good and the godly coming through that as well.